of Arizona is a public service of Rio Salado College. For more information, visit sunsounds.org.
At 7 o'clock, it is now time for the live reading of the August 8th issue of the Arizona Republic. Our readers this morning are Gene Gieseking and Alex Schaefer.
Good morning, Sun Sounds listeners. Here's the headlines from the Arizona Republic. Open carry law poses challenge.
And AZ energy companies may get competition.
Those are our two front page articles. They're kind of long, so let's start with the first one. Open carry law poses challenge, by Perry Vandal and Russ Wiles for the Republic. As people across the country mourn the mass shootings that ravaged El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, questions about how to prevent the next seemingly inevitable massacre reemerge. While lawmakers, lobbyists, and the general public argue about what should be done, police officers and business owners in Arizona are tasked with remaining vigilant in a state where nearly anyone over the age of 21 can carry a firearm, concealed or not, without a special permit or a license if they're not a convicted felon. The Arizona Department of Public Safety still issues concealed weapons permits, despite law changes from nearly a decade ago no longer requiring them. Bart Graves, a DPS spokesman, said the permits remain useful, even though they are no longer mandatory. Arizona is a permitless state, but a concealed weapons permit allows you to carry in some other states, Graves said in a written statement. It also helps when it comes to purchasing a gun through a licensed dealer because a background check has already been completed. But while concealed carry permits have become an optional convenience in Arizona, state gun laws still limit where one can bring a firearm and what they can do with it. While one doesn't need a permit to carry a gun, concealed or otherwise, there are places where you're not allowed to bring a gun. These generally include schools, other than the parking lots, polling places on election day, military installations, Indian reservations, game preserves, federal buildings, past the TSA checkpoint in airports, commercial nuclear or hydroelectric generating stations, and jails, prisons, and other correctional facilities. The law also allows businesses and other private property owners to dictate whether they will allow firearms on the premises by displaying a sign near the entrance. The sign typically is a red with a picture of a handgun that's been crossed out. Firearms are typically considered allowable in places that don't display the sign, though store managers and property owners can ask the gun carrier to leave. Now, the law is a little vague regarding how one can legally carry the gun. Russ Richelsoff, a partner at Davis Miles McGuire Gardner PLLC, said Arizona law doesn't specifically say one needs to have a gun holstered or slung across their back, but holding the firearm in one's hands can present problems. Richelsoff told the Arizona Republic, "You can carry a firearm in a holster, and that's generally not considered threatening. But once you remove the firearm from the holster, depending on the context of the situation, that could be deemed threatening, and then you could be charged with either disorderly conduct as a felony, or you could even be charged with aggravated assault if you actually point the weapon on somebody, even if you don't discharge it." Richelsoff said certain locations have limitations, such as school grounds where the firearm has to be locked in a case inside a vehicle that is parked in the lot. He also said people can bring firearms into the airport before the TSA checkpoint, but warned against walking into Sky Harbor with an AR-15 slung across one's back, like a neurosurgeon did back in 2014. He initially faced disorderly conduct charges after the muzzle allegedly faced toward a woman and her daughter, but they were dropped after he agreed to several terms laid out by the county attorney. Michael Scott, a clinical professor at Arizona State University's School of Criminology and Criminal Justice, said open carry law often brushes against disorderly conduct violations, which revolves around whether one's behavior is disturbing others. He said, and certainly, especially in the current climate with mass shootings, carrying a firearm openly into a busy, crowded public place or even into a business is likely to generate anxiety and fear and concern among other people. And I would argue that that potentially violates at least the disorderly conduct statute, if not a specific firearms law. Representatives from police agencies across the valley urged people to call law enforcement if an armed person makes them uncomfortable, even if it's simply the firearm's presence that concerned them. Detective Jason Flam, a spokesman for the Mesa Police Department, said he tends to err on the side of caution in situations where firearms are involved. Flam said, my belief is, as an officer, I'd rather respond somewhere and find out it's nothing more than someone being hesitant to call because they just weren't sure and had something go really bad. So if someone's concerned or something just doesn't look right, call us. We don't mind. When asked if there are certain signs or behaviors to look out for, Flam said various websites offer good advice, but there aren't too many clear signs. Flam said, if there was one thing we could look for, then we would always look for that, and we would stop a lot of shootings. But there's not one thing you can look for, because every active shooter has had different motives or different reasons for doing what they're doing. Sergeant Brian Reynolds, a spokesman for the Scottsdale Police Department, echoed Flam's recommendations to call law enforcement, even if merely concerned. Reynolds said, it's always okay to call law enforcement if you have a question or a question about anything, and particularly when it comes to a safety issue. In a store or other public place, he recommended that customers relay their concerns to a manager, who might be willing to ask the gun carrier to leave before contacting police. Reynolds said, if nobody from the store has been alerted to the potential issue, they're not going to know what we're talking about, and so then it just frustrates everyone's efforts to find out what exactly the issue is. He also said some people may carry firearms into businesses and public spaces to elicit a reaction from others. He said a lot of folks that do those things are looking for a response. They're looking for a response either from other citizens and or from law enforcement. We've all seen those videos on social media where law enforcement responds and then the individual wants to have a debate with the officer about what they can and cannot do. But Reynolds said it's imperative that people, including gun owners, obey an officer's directions, even if they're acting within the law, highlighting that respect is a two-way street. Reynolds said, while we appreciate that people have a Second Amendment right to carry firearms and to own them and so forth, you've got to be responsible as a firearms owner. And when a uniformed police officer approaches you and asks to speak to you or gives you commands and gives you an order, that's not the time to plead your case. Richelsoft's recommendation was practically identical to Reynolds. Richelsoft said, don't give the police any reason to believe that you're a threat. That's how people end up getting hurt. Retailers face tough obstacles in preventing mass killings like those that struck El Paso and Dayton. Unlike airports, stadiums, and other venues where security checkpoints have become common and certain items are prohibited, there usually aren't the same types of barriers at stores. The retail shopping experience is largely premised on the free flow of people in and out, including those carrying bulky packages that could conceal weapons. Besides, guns are allowed in public under open carry laws in Arizona and many other states, though private businesses do have the option of prohibiting them in Arizona. Robert Moraca, a vice president specializing in crime and loss prevention at the National Retail Federation, predicted retailers will take the opportunity to provide additional training to managers and employees on active shooter response situations. The recent shootings elevate heightened security awareness throughout the industry, he said in an email note to the Republic. Retailers will encourage their store managers to connect with mall managers, landlord security personnel, and law enforcement officials in their areas, while reminding managers and employees to notify authorities if they see something suspicious. Still, there are no practical security tools or measures to prevent retailers and other businesses from being victimized in these types of incidents. The Republic reached out to more than a dozen large retailers operating in the Phoenix area. Few companies responded. None were willing to discuss security changes or policies in detail, including Walmart, where the El Paso shootings occurred. Randy Hargrove, a Walmart spokesman, said, "We follow all federal and state regulations with regard to firearms," meaning the company would not restrict or block people authorized to carry guns into stores in Arizona and other states where it's legal to do so. He added, "There's no change to our policies at this time." Nancy Keene, a spokeswoman for Albertsons Safeway, said the safety of customers and employees is paramount. She said, "Our policy is to follow state and local laws as they relate to this issue," meaning customers are allowed to bring firearms into stores in states where the law allows it. Sprouts Farmers Market provided the most thorough explanation. Spokesman Diego Romero wrote in an email, "Each location posts signage to indicate that firearms are not allowed inside the store, except for those carried by law enforcement officers. Management will request any customer found in possession of a firearm or other dangerous weapon to remove it from the store or facility," he continued. Then he went on and said, "Store teams are provided mandatory active shooter training following official guidelines from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security." Various other large retailers, Home Depot, Kohl's, Lowe's, Target, McDonald's, and others, they didn't respond for comment. Retailers can take and are pursuing various safeguards to lessen the odds of a mass killing. More installation and active monitoring of video cameras with clean lines of sight are among solutions, as are more armed security guards and the use of security dogs, according to William Nesbitt, a consultant and president of Security Management Services International in Newberry Park, California. Many retailers also are emphasizing better training for store employees. But Nesbitt said, "Watching for suspicious behavior helps, but there are simply just no easy answers." And that was the front page article, "Open Carry Law Poses Challenges."
And we have AZ Energy Companies May Get Competition, Regulators Crafting Rules to Allow for Independent Power Producers, by Ryan Randazzo, Arizona Republic, USA Today Network. Someday soon in Arizona, you might get to pick your energy company rather than have no choice but to use the one that serves your neighborhood. Arizona Corporation Commission members recently spent 2 days discussing energy deregulation, alternately referred to as re-regulation or retail competition. The state regulators are crafting rules that would allow independent power producers to compete for customers with the big electric companies like Arizona Public Service Company. Proponents of the concept say that having electric companies compete for customers would drive down prices and improve customer service and reliability. They contend that electric companies have little reason to improve their operations because they have no threat of losing unhappy customers, unlike other businesses. The discussion is just getting started, but it promises to be contentious. Last year in Nevada, that state's dominant utility helped bankroll a $63 million campaign to oppose deregulation, while supporters spent more than $30 million on their cause. Voters ultimately rejected it at the ballot box. That amount far surpasses the record spending last year in Arizona on a failed clean energy ballot measure. Here are 7 things that will help you understand deregulation and what's under consideration in Arizona. How does this work? In a competitive market, the big electric companies like APS and Tucson Electric Power Company would continue to run their power lines, but not necessarily the actual power plants. The existing utilities would make money running the power lines, and the competing power providers would make money selling electricity to customers. Customers could buy power from other providers with that power sent across the lines run by the big utilities. They could choose who they buy power from, and the big utilities would be an option, but they also could choose to buy from competitors. That is not allowed in Arizona today, except in some special cases set up by regulators. Who would get freedom to choose? While some corporation commissioners are interested in offering residential customers the ability to shop for power, the staff at the Corporation Commission has initially proposed that only big businesses get to do so. The proposal from the Commission staff, which is only a starting point for the discussion, is to limit participation in the competitive market to business customers with a monthly demand of at least 100 kilowatts. The average home doesn't usually demand more than about 5 to 8 kilowatts. However, the Commission staff members also propose offering a community choice aggregation program where cities and towns could purchase power from companies other than their primary utility on behalf of residents and businesses in the community. Right now, we don't believe the public interest includes residential, said Elijah Abina, director of the Utilities Division of the Corporation Commission. Abina's division takes direction from the elected commissioners, though. So if they want to allow residential customer competition, Abina's staff will craft such rules. Commissioners asked Abina if a homeowners association could run a community choice aggregation or a CCA program rather than a city or town. Abina said the commission staff doesn't recommend giving that power to HOAs, which can foreclose on homes for violation of rules. We don't want a situation where an HOA will form a CCA and will have the power to disconnect or foreclose people's houses if they don't pay a bill or there is a dispute, Abina said. We are not recommending that HOAs be allowed to do a CCA for those reasons. What would change save you money? That is the question commissioners and stakeholders wrestled with the most during the recent meetings. Advocates point to low price in some of the deregulated states like Texas, while opponents undercut those arguments by saying Texas would have low prices anyhow thanks to its heavy reliance on low-price natural gas and abundant wind power. Commissioner Justin Olson is the most vocal supporter of competition and says he is convinced it would reduce prices for customers. He says he researched price data from the Energy Information Administration. That data shows that since 2008, there has been significant decrease in rates in the 14 states that have competition compared to a significant increase in rates in states that still prohibit competition in the energy sector, Olson said during the stakeholder meeting. The data and this evidence is quite convincing. Others are far less certain the data is clear. Not surprisingly, incumbent utilities are not supportive of allowing competition. And companies that would like to compete for customers in Arizona support the idea. Both sides highlight their own data showing benefits or drawbacks to consumer prices. Aside from those parties, some key stakeholders have concerns. The Residential Utility Consumer Office, a body created by the Arizona legislature to protect household utility customers, says it sees no clear evidence on price impacts one way or another, but that similar consumer protection agencies in other states have found customers overpaying in deregulated markets. Another key stakeholder is ARP, which is noteworthy because the group has no financial stake in the debate. Unlike RUCO and other stakeholders, ARP opposed the last APS rate hike rather than signing on to a settlement. But on the issue of deregulation, ARP, or AARP, sides with APS. Steve Jennings, the Associate State Director for ARP in Arizona, said the organization strongly opposes any move toward deregulation based on the bad experiences for consumers in other states. ARP is no stranger to the issue, Jennings said. In a word, we oppose going to retail electric choice. ARP operates in all 50 states, and we have seen a lot of experience with this. We have not seen a clear benefit in terms of reduced rates. Economists have debated the issue for 20 years or more, and the evidence is inconclusive. Jennings said that ARP finds many consumers in deregulated states are lured by promotional offers from competitive electric companies, and when they take those deals, the customers pay more for power than under a basic rate plan with their regular utility. Our opposition was mainly around consumer fraud, he said. A lot of businesses start up and take advantage of people. That's how you get that a large number of people who overpay. Commissioners Boyd Dunn and Chairman Robert Burns, who, like Olson, both support deregulation, challenged Jennings and whether Arizona's 900,000 ARPA members agreed with him. Another key question is the effect on residential customers if businesses are allowed to shop for power, but households are not. Opponents of deregulation say that likely would lead to higher prices for residential customers as the incumbent utilities lose revenues from big business customers and have to make it up from the remaining customer base. Hasn't Arizona tried this before? In the 1990s, the Corporation Commission worked on rules, and in 1999, electric competition was approved. Some changes were added in October 2000, but problems in the wholesale market caused competitive power companies to send customers back to the incumbent utilities. The California energy crisis in 2000 and 2001, with its rolling blackouts, also raised concern over deregulation, though Arizona was not directly affected. A lawsuit, Phelps Dodge Corp. versus Arizona Electric Power Cooperative, sought to clarify some of the ambiguities of deregulation. An Arizona appeals court ruling in 2004 in that case partially invalidated the rules passed by the commission. That effectively ended deregulation in the state, or at least stalled it till now. The new rules will take this court decision into account and attempt to address the legal issues presented by that decision. Maureen Scott, a commission attorney, said the Phelps Dodge case does not prevent a competitive market in Arizona, though it does set restrictions on Arizona's market structure. There are ways the commission can deal with those restrictions, Scott said. The commission began a similar review of deregulation in 2013, but voted abruptly to stop the meetings amid a concerted opposition campaign from APS. Commission lawyers at the time also warned that the Phelps Dodge decision was a concern. Salt River Project, a large public power company serving the Phoenix area, could see effects from anything the Corporation Commission approves, even though SRP is not usually subject to commission rules. That's because the state's previous move toward deregulation included laws relating to public power companies and competition in their territories from competitor power providers certified by the commission. SRP officials have urged the commission to proceed cautiously in the deregulation meeting. Which states allow competition? 13 states and the District of Columbia have full retail competition, and some others have partial competition where only aggregate or business customers can shop for electricity. The full retail states are Connecticut, Delaware, Washington, D.C., Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Texas. Customers must choose an electric company in Texas. Partial competition is allowed in California, Michigan, Nevada, Oregon, and Virginia. According to the Energy Information Administration, the programs are waning in popularity, with the number of customers participating in retail choice programs declining from a peak in 2014. And consumer complaints are common in some places. Last year, Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey issued a report that indicated customers overpaid for electricity by about $177 million from 2015 to 2017 through retail choice programs. Healey called for an end to the programs. More renewable energy in Arizona? Maybe. Some clean energy or solar advocates expect that if municipalities could choose, they would contract with renewable energy plants to provide a larger share of their electricity from renewables than is currently provided by Arizona utilities. That is the experience of some municipal programs in California. The rules proposed by Commission staff members would require any competitive energy provider to meet the state's renewable energy standard, which requires electricity providers to get increasing amounts of renewable energy until they reach 15% of their energy from renewables by 2025. But in Nevada last year, environmental groups opposed the deregulation effort. They were concerned that it would slow the development of renewables by that state's major utility. The Nevada utility, NV Energy, said if deregulation passed, it would not develop as much solar as planned. A different concern is deregulation could also affect rooftop solar installations. The various energy providers might have different ways to credit customers for surplus energy from solar panels. Policies regarding rooftop solar in Arizona have already prompted intense political battles. The deregulation discussion likely will get close attention from renewable energy advocates who want to ensure homeowners are not discouraged from installing solar. And finally, what happens next? After reviewing the proposal, commissioners eventually will need to vote on whether to initiate a formal rulemaking, which a majority seems to favor at this point. But when that vote could happen is unclear. If they vote to initiate a rulemaking, it could take 6 months to a year to pass the new rule. Meanwhile, commissioners asked the staff to make additional modifications on the proposed rule, and in the coming weeks, commissioners are expected to file their questions and suggestions to the public docket on the issue. And that article was AZ Energy Companies May Get Competition.
It's 7:26. We finished the two articles from the front page. Now we turn to the interior of the first section of the paper and take a look at some articles from around the valley and state and nation. This first one is by Rafael Carranza from The Republic, and its dateline is from Ciudad Juarez. First services for an El Paso shooting victim are held. The remains of Elsa Mendoza de la Mora, one of 22 people killed in the Saturday massacre at an El Paso Walmart, arrived in Ciudad Juarez on Wednesday afternoon. The funeral service for her is the first for any of the victims of Saturday's deadly shooting. Her husband and two children have been inconsolable, said Alma Varga Marquez, who is Mendoza de la Mora's cousin. She went on and said they still can't believe something like this happened to her. Mendoza de la Mora worked as a principal at an elementary school in Juarez. Family members, friends, and colleagues will gather at Recinto de la Oración Cemetery in Ciudad Juarez today, where the funeral services will continue with her burial. Mendoza de la Mora had stopped at the Walmart on Saturday to pick up a few items while her husband, Antonio de la Mora, who's a professor at the Autonomous University of Ciudad Juarez, and their younger child waited in the car. She never made it back. The Mexican government identified her the following day as one of 8 Mexican nationals killed in the attack, although the city of El Paso listed her as also having U.S. citizenship. Friends and teaching colleagues present at the funeral home said they were shocked to learn about her death. They said they wanted to pay their respects to her family, who many of them have known for years. After the shooting at the Walmart, Mendoza de la Mora's remains were transported to the El Paso County Medical Examiner. Her family worked with the Mexican consulate in El Paso to bring her body back to Juarez. And that was the article entitled, First Services for an El Paso Shooting Victim Are Held.
United Methodist Bishop Urges Flock to Get Political by John Dana, Arizona Republic, USA Today Network. Saying that prayers are not enough to stop the evil that is upon us, the leader of the Desert Southwest's 135 United Methodist Churches called on his flock to rise to action against the rising tide of gun violence and white supremacy. Our world is darkened by deep despair at the proliferation of violence and hatred, Bishop Robert Hoshibata wrote in a letter posted on Facebook late Tuesday. Acts of racism and senseless gun violence now should call us to action. As disciples of Jesus who proclaim the realm of God, we should be angered to do something to stop the evil that is upon us. Hoshibata is the spiritual leader of the Desert Church's Desert Southwest Conference, which includes 135 churches in Arizona and southern Nevada, including Las Vegas. The United Methodist Church is the largest mainline Protestant denomination in Arizona, according to the Pew Research Center's Religious Landscape Study. Hoshibata's letter came as the communities of El Paso and Dayton, Ohio, struggled to cope in the aftermath of mass shootings that occurred 18 hours apart and claimed the lives of 31 people. While authorities have not suggested a motive in the Dayton shooting, the El Paso gunman, who was captured unharmed, had posted a screed expressing a racist ideology and hatred of Mexican immigrants just moments before he opened fire. Hoshibata said he was offended by the lack of action by elected leaders and called upon church members to write their representatives in Congress, as well as to donate to groups that work to combat gun violence. "We can no longer be content to offer our thoughts and prayers. Thoughts and prayers are not enough, especially if you are as horrified as I am," he wrote in the letter, which was shared on Facebook pages of Methodist churches across the valley. "I am offended by the lack of action by those who are in authority to move us beyond an impasse and do not. We should all be wary of those who blame the current frequency of violence only on mental health issues or social media," he said. He listed the other factors that should be addressed instead: the continued proliferation of the scourge of racism and white supremacy, the brazen expressions and actions of hate and contempt for others, the disregard of the precious gift of life we have been given by God, the rampant availability of weapons, especially weapons designed for mass destruction, and the refusal to countermand organizations like the National Rifle Association that roadblock efforts to address common sense gun laws. The reaction on Facebook to Hoshibata's letter was generally supportive, but several commentators said the church needed to continue to focus on its own internal policies regarding the inclusion of LGBTQ members. The Worldwide United Methodist Church, led largely by members in conservative African nations, voted earlier this year to strictly enforce 1970s-era bans on LGBTQ members, with harsh penalties for clergy who minister to them or perform marriages. These policies have been widely opposed in the U.S., including the Desert Southwest Conference, where a number of ministers have been vocal in their opposition and have quietly defied the worldwide church policies. Other members said they were glad to see Hoshibata take a stand. "Thank you for your call and a plan of action. I've been struggling with what I can do. Doing it now," wrote Deborah Durrell. Betty Neal wrote, "As someone who lost a beloved grandson, I never want to hear a person say thoughts and prayers. Stop giving us your thoughts. You can show love enough to take action. Use our democratic process. Speak up and vote." Hoshibata closed his letter by saying, "Pray with me that there can be some movement in our call to respond to our United Methodist stance against violence. Let's put faith into action. Your voice matters, so let it be heard. Your faith in Jesus Christ mandates that we do so." And that was, "United Methodist Bishop Urges Flock to Get Political."
Our next article is entitled, "Mesa Man Wants to Challenge Tax Break for Religious Leaders." It's an article by Russ Wiles for The Republic. Luke Douglas won't file his next income tax return until early in next year, 2020. But he is already prepared to hear from the Internal Revenue Service. That's because the Mesa resident plans to claim a tax break that is available only to ministers and other religious clergy. Douglas serves as an ordained celebrant or leader for the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix. He can preside at weddings, funerals, invocations, and other events. But his group isn't religious, and he doesn't believe in God. For ministers, priests, rabbis, imams, and other ordained religious leaders who do, there is a parsonage exemption that is available to skirt taxes on whatever housing allowances or benefits they receive from their churches, temples, mosques, or other houses of worship. Andrew Gutierrez, who is senior pastor at Canyon Bible Church of Prescott, said, "The parsonage exemption is helpful for me to afford to do the job full time. Without it, I'd probably need to get another job." More specifically, religious leaders known as ministers of the gospel, but extending beyond Christians, don't declare as taxable income the value of housing allowances provided to them, assuming they don't live in church-owned housing. For a minister receiving perhaps $1,000 a month for housing, that allowance would save roughly $1,400 to $2,600 in taxes annually, assuming the person is in either the 12% or 22% federal brackets, which are the two most common middle-class thresholds. In Douglas's case, the Humanist Society gives him a housing allowance of $1,000 a month. He doesn't intend to declare the amount or to pay taxes on it when filing his federal and Arizona returns early next year. The rationale for the parsonage exemption, which has existed for decades, was to enable ministers and other religious officials to live near and interact more closely with their congregations. For example, in a commentary by the Jewish Press, Jews who cannot drive on religious days, including the Sabbath, especially benefit from this exemption. Then, if a Muslim imam earns $64,000 and receives $24,000 from his mosque as a designated housing allowance, then the imam will only have to report $40,000 as gross income for income tax purposes. That's a quote from an example provided by the Islamic Legal blog. Gutierrez at the Prescott Church said the parsonage exemption helps him to live fairly close to his church, about 6 miles away. He said, "I'm on call all the time. If someone goes into the hospital, I need to be there." Unlike recent legal challenges that sought to strike down the tax rule as a government subsidy and endorsement of religion, Douglas mainly wants to broaden the reach of the parsonage exemption beyond ministers, pastors, rabbis, and the like. If the IRS doesn't object, other nonprofit leaders could be encouraged to claim the tax break. He said, "We believe it should apply equally to nonprofit leaders across the board." The Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix is a nonprofit group that includes atheists, agnostics, and other free thinkers, he said. Recent lawsuits regarding the parsonage exemption have questioned whether it provides an unconstitutional endorsement and subsidization of religion. The Freedom From Religion Foundation earlier this year lost a challenge to the law in the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. A lower court judge earlier had ruled in the group's favor. The statement from the Freedom From Religion Foundation in a recent commentary said, "Ministers of the gospel may uniquely claim these benefits. The law thus provides a government endorsement of religion and religious employees over others, contrary to the Constitution," the group maintains. Annie Laurie Gaylor, the foundation's co-president, said the group has decided not to appeal the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court for now, citing the court's conservative leaning. She said, "When you count heads on the high court, how could we prevail?" The foundation would prefer that Congress or the courts abolish the tax break, but failing that, would like to see it expanded to secular organizations. The exemption puts ministers on a special level and gives them a special reward, she said. Scottsdale-based Alliance Defending Freedom, which filed a friend of the court brief to defend the parsonage exemption, countered that the rule doesn't transfer any public money to ministers or religious organizations, and it doesn't result in any administrative or financial relationship with the government. The law, which has been around for more than half a century, is a permissible accommodation of religion consistent with our nation's long-standing practice of exempting churches and other religious organizations from government-imposed tax burdens. That's what the group wrote in their legal brief. The group declined further comment for this article. Adam Chodorow, an Arizona State University law professor, is convinced the parsonage exemption violates the First Amendment. In an email to the Arizona Republic, Chodorow said he thinks the Seventh Circuit Court made the wrong decision, adding that another venue, such as the more liberal Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, could arrive at a different conclusion. At any rate, he predicts the IRS will follow the Seventh Circuit ruling and deny exemptions for non-religious leaders, such as Douglas. In an article for a University of California Law Review last year, Chodorow argued that the exemption represents a religious subsidy and is an example of church-state entanglement. He also cited a Treasury Department estimate that the exemption could cost $9.3 billion in foregone federal taxes over roughly the next decade, or nearly $1 billion per year, reflecting on about $37 billion in untaxed income. However, it's difficult to estimate the cost precisely because members of the clergy don't report the value of their housing allowances. A Christianity Today article estimated 84% of clergy take advantage of it. The court brief filed by Alliance Defending Freedom was signed by nearly 8,900 ministers and other church representatives from around the nation. Stacy Kinkle, business manager at Arizona Community Church in Tempe, said the parsonage exemption helps ministers who might not receive high wages. Kinkle said in an interview, "For the education and experience that they have, they're not necessarily earning what they could in industry doing similar work." She estimated that Arizona ministers generally earn between $40,000 and $80,000 a year. Stephen Harris, a minister with Arizona Assemblies of God, said he has claimed the parsonage exemption since 1976, when he made $110 a week, which was barely more than the prevailing minimum wage at the time. Harris said, "It's a huge break for ministers who don't make a lot of money. I'm grateful that they give it to us." Ministers and other religious figures employed by a congregation do pay taxes on their wages, according to IRS publication 517. They're also liable for taxes on fees received directly from congregation members to perform marriages, baptism, and other services. Minister income also is subject to Social Security and Medicare taxes. Besides rent, allowances for clergy also can be used to pay mortgage interest, utility expenses, and other housing costs. And clergy homeowners still may claim property tax and mortgage interest deductions. The dollar amount of that exemption is not capped. Chodro wrote in his article, "Excluding a portion of ministerial income from the income tax does not amount to leaving ministers and churches alone. Simply provides ministers a special benefit unavailable to others." Well, Duke Douglas said he believes he will be the first humanist celebrant to test the IRS by claiming the parsonage exemption. If the IRS doesn't object, he expects that more nonprofit leaders will follow his lead. Conversely, if the tax agency disallows the exemption, Douglas vows that various secular groups could mount a legal challenge on his behalf, but he didn't name any specific organizations. And that's the article. Mesa Man wants to challenge tax break for religious leaders.
And motorcycle backfire causes some panic in New York City's Times Square area, from the Associated Press. From New York City, frantic people scrambled to get out of Times Square on Tuesday evening, pounding on theater doors to find a place to hide after the sound of a motorcycle backfiring caused fear that gunshots were being fired in the wake of mass shootings in other American cities. The New York Police Department, which said it received multiple 911 calls about the tumult, tweeted a reassurance. "There is no hashtag active shooter in hashtag Times Square. Motorcycles backfiring while passing through sounded like gunshots. Please don't panic. The Times Square area is very safe," the department added. But after 31 people were killed in two mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, in less than 24 hours over the weekend, the sudden discharge of loud noises Tuesday night had people screaming as they fled in one of New York City's most popular areas. "You hear a noise, you run. That's the state of this nation, and we're petrified," Governor Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, said Wednesday as he reflected on the panic. Video footage showed the throngs rushing out of the busy tourism and entertainment area, with some taking cover behind vehicles. Gideon Glick, an actor in To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway, said the show at the Schubert Theater had to be stopped because of the chaos. "Screaming civilians tried to storm our theater for safety. The audience started screaming and the cast fled the stage," he wrote on Twitter. "This is the world we live in. This cannot be our world." The Fire Department of New York said 9 people were hurt altogether, with 6 transported to hospitals. Most injuries were minor. That was Motorcycle Backfire Causes Some Panic in New York City's Times Square Area.
As we come up on 7:45, we have an article from the USA Today section of the paper, and then just a couple more articles from the Arizona Republic. We want to get this one from the USA Today right now. It's called Trump Faces Protest on Visit. It's an Associated Press article out of El Paso, Texas. Aiming to play the traditional role of healer during national tragedy, President Donald Trump paid visits Wednesday to two cities reeling from mass shootings that left 31 dead and dozens more wounded. But his divisive words preceded him, large protests greeted him, and biting political attacks soon followed. The President and First Lady Melania Trump flew to El Paso late in the day after visiting the Dayton Hospital, where many of the victims of Sunday's attack in that city were treated. The President was kept out of view of the reporters traveling with him, but White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham said the couple met with hospital staff and first responders and spent time with wounded survivors and their families. Trump told them he was with them, she said. Everybody received him very warmly. Everybody was very, very excited to see him. But outside Miami Valley Hospital, at least 200 protesters gathered, blaming Trump's incendiary rhetoric for inflaming political and racial tensions in the country and demanding action on gun control. Some said Trump was not welcome in their city. There were Trump supporters as well. Emotions are still raw in the aftermath of the early Sunday morning shooting rampage that left 10 dead, including the gunman, in the city's popular Oregon Entertainment District. Critics contend that Trump's own words have contributed to a combustible climate that has spawned violence in cities, including El Paso, where another shooter killed 22 people over the weekend. Trump and the White House have forcefully disputed the idea that he bears some responsibility for the nation's divisions, and Trump continued to do so as he left for the trip on Wednesday. Trump said, "My critics are political people," noting the apparent political leanings of the shooter in the Dayton killings. He also defended his rhetoric on issues involving immigration, claiming instead that he brings people together. In Dayton, raw anger and pain were on display as protesters chanted, "Ban those guns and do something," during Trump's visit. Holding a sign that said, "Not welcome here," Linnell Graham said she thinks Trump's response to the shootings has been insincere. She said, "To me, he comes off as fake." But in El Paso, where more protests awaited, Raul Melendez, whose father-in-law, David Johnson, was killed in Saturday's shooting, said the most appropriate thing Trump could do was to meet with relatives of the victims. Melendez, who credits Johnson with helping his 9-year-old daughter survive the attack by pushing her under a counter, said it shows that he actually cares if he talks to individual families. Melendez, an Army veteran and the son of Mexican immigrants, said he holds only the shooter responsible for the attack. He said that person had the intent to hurt people. He already had it. No one's words would have triggered that. Local Democratic lawmakers who had expressed concern about the visit said Trump had nonetheless hit the right notes Wednesday. Ohio U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, who said he was comforting, he did the right things, and Melania did the right things. It is his job to comfort people. She nonetheless said he was very concerned about a president that divides in his rhetoric and plays to race in his rhetoric. Mayor Nan Whaley, who said she was glad Trump had not stopped at the site of the shooting, said, "I think the victims and the first responders were grateful that the President of the United States came to Dayton." She said, "A lot of the time his talk can be very divisive, and that's the last thing we need in Dayton." The discord continued in El Paso. Representative Veronica Escobar, the Democratic congresswoman who represents the city, declined to even meet with Trump. "I refuse to be a prop," she said in an interview on CNN. Visits to the sites of mass shootings have become a regular pilgrimage for recent president, but Trump, who has sometimes struggled to project empathy during moments of national tragedy, has stirred unusual backlash. Though he has been able to summon soothing words and connect one-on-one with victims, he often quickly lapses into divisive tweets and statements, just recently painting immigrants as invaders, suggesting four Democratic congresswomen of color should go back to their home countries, even though they're U.S. citizens. Even on the eve of this trip, Trump was lashing out at a potential 2020 rival, former Representative Beto O'Rourke, who had tweeted that Trump helped create the hatred that made Chatterjee's tragedy possible and should not come to El Paso. Trump snapped back, "O'Rourke should respect the victims and law enforcement and be quiet." That's the article from the USA Today section, "Trump Faces Protest on Visits."
Tucson to vote on sanctuary city law in November, from the Associated Press. Officials in Tucson approved placing a sanctuary city measure on the ballot at a city council meeting that later went viral on social media. The Tucson City Council voted Tuesday night to allow the initiative on the November ballot, which could potentially lead to Arizona's first ever sanctuary city, KVOA-TV reported. Video from the TV station shows a woman wearing a Make America Great Again hat, repeatedly shouting that the city does not defy or change immigration laws. Several people can be heard booing, and an unidentified man in a green polo shirt is shown laughing at her from his seat. Hashtag Green Shirt Guy was the number one trending topic on Twitter as of Wednesday morning, with the clip already drawing more than 1 million views. Council members were required to vote after the measure got more than the minimum required number of petition signatures. The initiative aims to add protections for people living in the U.S. illegally, including preventing Tucson police from asking about immigration status and prohibiting certain cooperation between city and federal agencies. The council vote comes at a time when a mass shooting in Texas has put spotlight on the immigration rhetoric. Authorities believe a hate-filled anti-immigrant manifesto was written by the gunman who killed 22 people and wounded numerous others at an El Paso Walmart on Saturday. Many have denounced President Donald Trump for using incendiary words that mirror some of the language linked to the shooter. The Sanctuary City initiative is currently the subject of a lawsuit filed by the Pima County Republican Party in July. The suit is challenging individual signatures and whether paid signature gatherers filled out the forms correctly. It also argues the minimum number of necessary signatures was too low. More than 12,400 signatures were certified by the Pima County Recorder's Office. That is roughly 3,100 more than the minimum required to qualify for the ballot. Others opposing the initiative include the three Democrats running to be Tucson's next mayor. The candidates said sanctuary status could create more problems, such as the state legislature eliminating millions of dollars in annual state shared revenue as a punishment. There are no Republicans in the mayoral race. And that was Tucson to vote on sanctuary city law in November.
Report of weapon clears Gannett headquarters by Ann Ryman for The Republic. Police finished an hours-long search of the offices of Gannett and USA Today in McLean, Virginia, on Wednesday afternoon after finding no evidence that a crime occurred, following reports that a person was in the building with a weapon. Fairfax County Police Chief Edwin C. Rossler, Jr., in a news briefing shortly after 3 p.m., said, "Our prayers have been answered. Everybody is safe." He said police have a person of interest who was located in another area of Fairfax County and was being interviewed by police. He said there was no evidence the person committed a crime. Police conducted a floor-by-floor search of the building on Wednesday afternoon, treating the event as if an active shooter was in the building, after receiving a 911 call at 11:56 a.m. reporting that a former employee was in the building with a weapon. Rossler did not specify what company previously employed that person. The site holds the headquarters for Gannett Company, which is the parent company of USA Today and the Arizona Republic. It also houses a variety of other businesses. When asked whether the person of interest was a Gannett employee, the police chief responded, "I have no evidence it was a Gannett employee. They lease office space. There is no nexus to Gannett Company itself at this time. The police chief said the investigation is continuing. He declined comment on whether there actually was an armed person in the building on Wednesday. He said, "We need to clarify through video review, re-interview those who observed to confirm or deny that." Earlier in the day, alarms sounded at the building as police vehicles converged on the scene. Law enforcement officers with rifles and body armor were patrolling the area, and a helicopter hovered overhead. Police warned people to avoid the area, which is near the Capitol Beltway, major regional malls, and office buildings. And that was a report of Weapon Clears Gannett HQ.
And some brief items from USA Today. Stroke sues FBI for firing him over anti-Trump text messages. An FBI agent who wrote derogatory text messages about Donald Trump filed a lawsuit Tuesday, charging that the Bureau caved to unrelenting pressure from the president when it fired him. The suit from Peter Stroke also alleges he was unfairly punished for expressing his political opinions and that the Justice Department violated its privacy when it shared hundreds of his text messages with reporters. The lawsuit seeks reinstatement to the FBI, back pay, and a declaration that the government violated his rights. And Trump and the Republican Party sue over California tax return law. The Trump campaign and Republican Party sued California on Tuesday over a new law requiring presidential candidates to release their tax returns to run in the state's primary. One of the suits contends California's law is a naked political attack against the sitting president of the United States. It does not include a similar requirement for the general election. The law signed last week by Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is aimed at prying loose President Donald Trump's unreleased tax returns. And it is almost 7:57, so it's time for us to take a break for a few minutes.
We will continue with the live reading of this morning's Arizona Republic in just a few moments. But right now, we'll take a look at some of the television highlights for tonight, Thursday, August 8th. On Channel 5, the CBS affiliate, beginning at primetime 7 o'clock this evening, Big Bang Theory. Young Sheldon follows at 7:30. Big Brother is the program at 8 o'clock. Elementary airs at 9 o'clock. And Channel 5 begins the news at 10. PBS programming is on Channel 8, first up at 7 o'clock. I'll Have What Phil's Having. Masterpiece airs at 8 o'clock, followed by Hillary at 9. Horizon is the program at 10. Fox programming is on Channel 10. First up at 7 o'clock is Master Chef. Spin the Wheel follows at 8 o'clock, with the news beginning on Channel 10 at 9. Channel 12 airs NBC programming. At 7 o'clock this evening, NFL preseason.